NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, from Chicago in the 1970s to courtrooms in Ulster County today, the fight for reproductive rights continues. Author and activist Laura Kaplan joins us to share the story of Jane and what it means in this moment as Texas sues Ulster County over New York's abortion shield law. School's back, and so are some after-school programs. We'll hear how the Cooperage is sparking creativity with middle schoolers, and while they're throwing a birthday bash of their own. 100 years of golf in Sullivan County, and they're throwing a party to prove it. Details coming up. And live music this weekend with Alice Howe and Freebo at the Keshuckton Pump House. We'll talk with them about their music, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel's military is mobilizing tens of thousands of soldiers.
Going into the new year, what are
Netanyahu has ordered military officials to speed up preparations to take control of Gaza City. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel's military says it's calling up 60,000 new reservist soldiers to report for duty beginning in September. That will bring the total number of mobilized reservists to 120,000. It's part of the military's plans to displace hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza City, encircle the city, and send soldiers to battle Hamas inside the city. It's one of the last major areas Israel has not yet taken over in Gaza. Israel considers it a Hamas stronghold. Families of hostages are planning a protest outside Israel's military headquarters today against the planned offensive. They said it would endanger soldiers and hostages. Israel is considering a ceasefire deal Hamas endorsed on Monday to release half of the hostages in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Texas House has passed a Republican plan to redraw the congressional districts in that state. The goal is to flip five Democratic seats in the U.S. Congress to Republican control, cutting Democratic power. Texas state Democrats fled their state for 2 weeks trying to block the plan. They say the redistricting process will severely shrink or eliminate any power for Black or Latino voters. Texas Republican Representative Katrina Pearson scolded the Democrats for their defiance.
You can throw your tantrum, you can leave, you can run, and you can ignore the will of the rest of the voters. But it's honestly time to pick a new narrative. The racist rhetoric is old.
The measure has gone to the Texas State Senate. Separately, California state lawmakers are meeting today to review a Democratic plan that would seek to flip five Republican districts to Democratic control. This effort is opposed by California Republicans. Stocks opened lower this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a modest uptick in home sales last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 140 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes rose by 2% in July compared to the previous month. Sales were up just under 1% from this time last year. The average selling price showed little change at just over $422,000. Cautious shoppers continue to flock to Walmart for bargains. The retail giant reported better-than-expected sales in its most recent quarter, but profits fell shy of what forecasters had predicted. Walmart has raised some prices to cover the cost of President Trump's tariffs, but so far the discounter has not passed all the cost of those import taxes on to consumers. New applications for unemployment benefits rose last week. 235,000 people applied for jobless aid, 11,000 more than the previous week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. The annual economic summit, sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, opens today. It's in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Economists, central bankers, and policy leaders will meet there. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell will deliver a highly anticipated speech. Parole hearings get underway today in Southern California for the Menendez brothers. They were convicted of killing their parents in 1989 and have been behind bars for more than 30 years. Steve Futterman reports from San Diego. Supporters argue the two should be released, citing allegations the brothers were sexually abused by their father.
From the prison here where Eric and Lyle Menendez are being held, they will take part by video link in 2 days of hearings. Today's parole hearing is for Eric Menendez. Tomorrow, Lyle Menendez will appear before the board. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson says the board will want to hear from both of them, but allegations of abuse will likely not be a key factor.
The focus will not be so much on the nature of the crime, but really, are they prepared to go into the outside world?
Relatives of the brothers will appear on their behalf. The L.A. County District Attorney opposes their release. Even if the board recommends release, it can still be vetoed by California Governor Gavin Newsom. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in San Diego.
Conservative Christian leader and founder of the organization Focus on the Family, James Dobson, died today, according to a statement from the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute. In 2005, James Dobson was called the nation's most influential evangelical leader by the New York Times. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. This morning, we're revisiting a powerful piece of history that feels more urgent than ever. Before Roe v. Wade legalized abortion nationwide, a group of women in Chicago, known as Jane, formed an underground network to provide safe, affordable abortions when no one else would. Author Laura Kaplan chronicled their work in her book, The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. She was a member of Jane herself, and today she joins us as the fight over reproductive rights takes a new shape, including here in Ulster County, New York, where Texas is suing Ulster County Clerk Taylor Bruck in a case testing the state's abortion shield law. Laura Kaplan is joining us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura, you were part of the underground collective Jane that I mentioned that provided abortions in Chicago before Roe v. Wade. Can you take us back to that time and what drove you to join and what did that work feel like on the ground?
Yes. So this was a time before Roe when abortion was basically illegal in most of the United States. And it was also the very beginnings of the women's movement, or that phase of the women's movement, where groups of women were getting together and talking about issues pertaining to women. And, of course, abortion would always come up as a topic. You know, we thought that it was very rare and that every once in a while a woman had an illegal abortion and she died from it. We'd seen the pictures in the newspapers of the crumpled bodies in the alleyways. But when women started talking to each other, they discovered that lots of women looked for abortions. Many of them found them, and though they weren't pleasant experiences, they survived. And so women all over the country decided to make this passage through the underground network better for women, and organized groups like Jane around the country to suss out the more competent illegal practitioners, prepare women, and raise money because illegal abortions were extremely expensive to help pay for the abortions, raise money to help pay for the abortions. And that's just what this group in Chicago, which was officially known as the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation in Chicago, did. Jane was our code name so that when we called people, we could leave a message that wouldn't implicate them in anything. We could just say Jane was calling.
What was the moment you realized the movement, the network, was making a difference?
As soon as I joined. Now, I didn't join at the very beginning. The group started in the spring of 1969. I joined in the fall of 1971. By then, it was a going concern and had evolved rather dramatically, because unlike these other abortion referral services, and some were run by clergy groups, the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion, started by Howard Moody at Judson Memorial Church in New York. And then there were other clergy consultation services all over the country that Howard helped found, including in Chicago. But Jane evolved in a rather dramatic and unique way, in that in about a year and a half, we had learned to do the abortions ourselves. And those were DNCs, because there weren't medical abortions back in those days. We, the members of the group at that time, felt that just sending women off and saying, we've used this person before and everybody comes back alive, was not really much much comfort. And they felt that to give women control over this, they had to take control. And so they looked for somebody who they were working with already that they could control, and found that person. And within a year and a half, as I said, learned to do the abortions themselves. So when I joined in the fall of 71, was just at that transition point at which the women were taking over. I didn't know that when I joined the group. I didn't really know very much of anything about how exactly the history of the group, how it evolved. But I came in as a counselor, as we all did, and that was the basis of our work. We counseled women in our own homes and prepared them not only for exactly what would happen during the course of the abortion, but who would be there, what it would feel like, what they could expect after, everything they needed to know, including a lot of information on birth control and how their bodies worked. Because unlike today, when you go into a bookstore and there's rows and rows of books on women's health, there was nothing back in the late 60s, early 70s. Our bodies ourselves didn't come out until late 1970. And that was the first of what would become many books and a lot of information about women's health.
It's a vivid history that you outlined in the story of Jane, about dignity and empowerment, but it was also secretive and an illegal operation at the time. Do you think that young people today fully understand what pre-Roe life was like?
I don't know whether they do or not, but they're waking up to it pretty rapidly, especially in some parts of the country. And I think that the story of Jane can provide not necessarily a blueprint, but the sense that it's possible to resist, it's possible to organize ordinary people from their ordinary walks of life getting together because they have a concern, and to make life better for all people.
And looking more at today's landscape, you know, locally, just this summer, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued Ulster County Clerk Taylor Bruck for refusing to enforce a Texas judgment against a New York doctor who mailed abortion pills. What does a case like this stir up for you as someone who lived through the pre-Roe restrictions?
I don't know exactly what to say to that. I appreciate what Ulster County is doing, and I'm very happy that I live in Ulster County. And also, New York has always been a bastion for women's health. You know, it was really the first state to legalize abortion in the summer of 1970 and has stayed pretty steadfast. Now, of course, when that happened in 1970, there were groups of radicals who were not happy with the way New York went about it, and they proposed their ideal abortion legislation, which was a blank sheet of paper, because they felt that as soon as you allow the state to intervene in any way in women's health decisions, that it opens the door to further and further restrictions. And we've certainly seen that happen around the country, not here in New York. So New York has a very long, proud history of standing up, and I'm glad to see that continue.
Do you see parallels between what Jane was doing underground and what activists or providers face now under restrictive state laws other than New York's?
Absolutely. And I've been asked by reporters about this, you know, do I know who's doing what? And I always say the same thing, which is, I really don't know. And if I did know, I wouldn't tell a reporter, because the way to succeed is to be underground.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to author Laura Kaplan about her book, The Story of Jane, The Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service, about reproductive rights and pre-Roe in America, and also how it resonates today. Speaking a little bit more about...
Yeah. So, Tim, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I hope that our story provides young women, because it's always young women. We were, almost all of us were in our 20s at the time. I was 24 when I joined Jane. Provide them with the understanding that action is possible and necessary and doable.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, with states like Texas trying to extend their laws beyond their borders, do you think we're entering a new era of organizing, underground organizing, or a 21st century version of Jane, or do you think it's necessary that we do?
I think it's absolutely necessary, and I think we are. And, other countries have done similar things as well. There's a Latin American country where there were a group of women organized and got access to the medications used for abortions and did basically the same thing we did, only without having to do surgery.
And
those are all templates for how to move forward.
I just want
young people to know that all of this is possible, and that you don't have to be an unusual person. We were a group of ordinary women who came together through our various, what we came out of. Some were students, some were housewives, some were teachers. There were a couple of social workers in the group. There were no medical professionals in the group. So we were all lay people, and we started out where we knew nothing and we could do nothing. And by the end of it, which was we folded shortly after, a few months after Roe was decided, we could do it all. And we knew an amazing amount. It certainly transformed our lives. And we wanted it to transform the lives of the women who called us. You know, in those 4 years, we estimate, because being illegal, we didn't keep any records, but we estimate we performed over 11,000 low-cost abortions for women in the city of Chicago and in the surrounding area.
Today's women's...
So we had a whole system, you know.
Yeah.
We got one of the first answering machines, because another thing to remember, back then there was no technology.
Well, I was about to ask you about the technology.
Nobody had answering machines. Nobody had cell phones. There were no computers.
Yeah.
None of that.
Well, today's women's networks have that technology, so you're letting them know that, you know, it's not only possible, but even more possible because of the technology. And what are the other lessons from Jane's history that you believe are most urgent for activists, policymakers to remember right now?
I think the important thing for activists is to remember you start from what you can do. And it may be a very small thing. raising money for the many abortion funds around the country. That's one thing. You start with what you can do, which is what we did, and then you keep the needs of people at the forefront in your mind, and you do what you need to do to move towards that, and you can wind up in the most amazing places like we did. We never expected to do what we did. It was just, as one of the members said to me when I interviewed her, you know, you will put one foot in front of the other, and there you are in the middle of it. You know, you just move forward. And you always start with what you can do right now. It may be a very small thing, but that small thing can grow.
After all these decades for you, what gives you hope about the fight for reproductive freedom today?
Well, I think what gives me hope is the younger folks, because radical social change is always in the hands of the young people. And I've talked to so many students and young activists around the country over the years, and I see the fire in their eyes and their willingness to stretch themselves beyond what they thought they could do. And so that's very heartening. And I also think that we have come too far and we're not going back. I mean, that's just not happening. We're not returning to the 1950s as much as some in power would like that scenario to unfold. It's just not happening.
And if someone wants to try to get involved or learn more, what would you encourage them to do?
Find other people. And I'm going to quote another woman who is in Jane who said to me, you can't ever do this stuff alone. You know, trying to do something alone, she said, is like trying to start a fire with wet wood. You just need one or two other people, and you just see what the need is and how you can fulfill that need. And, you know, I have no blueprint. I have no, you know, here's how to do it step by step. Look for groups. There's the National Network of Abortion Funds. It's a great organization that people can access easily and talk with. You know, starting an abortion fund in their community is always a good way to begin. But I have a lot of faith in young people to figure out what needs to be done and to do it.
That's Laura Kaplan, author of The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. Laura, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Cooperage in Hounsdale is coming of age, celebrating 13 years and launching a new season of youth programs. We'll talk with Director of Programming Amanda Masters after this. This is Radio Chatsco.
Hi, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
And I'm Dwayne Brown.
We normally bring you the NPR newscast each hour, but today we're here with something different.
That's right. We're sharing some recent NPR donor comments from listeners all across the country, like William in Arizona. He donated because the truth matters. I couldn't have said it better myself, William.
Anita in Maryland says, free and fair news is important for me and those in my diverse community to thrive and understand one another.
Biora in Florida donated to support, quote, dependable, informative, brave reporting. I could go on and on.
Okay, we'll end with Joe in Kentucky, who says, I can't imagine a world without public radio.
If you can't imagine a world without public radio either, please join the community of NPR network supporters and give to this station today.
Here's how, and thank you.
Make your donation at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The new school year is right around the corner, and that means after-school programs are gearing up, too. Here in our region, the Cooperage Project in Honesdale is preparing to launch another season of youth programs, including its hands-on project-based pop-up club for middle schoolers. And at the same time, the Cooperage itself is marking a milestone birthday, turning 13 this year with a community celebration later this month. Joining us live to tell us what's ahead is Amanda Masters, Director of Programming at the Cooperage. Amanda, hello.
Hi there.
The new school year starting soon, as I mentioned, which means your after-school activities will be kicking off as well. What does the Cooperage have in store for kids and middle schoolers?
We are about to launch into an extremely busy time of year. It's very exciting. School districts in Wayne County are coming back to school in the coming week and the following week, depending on the district. And just a few weeks later, in mid-September, we will be restarting the ninth season of Pop-Up Club, which is an after-school program for 6th through 8th grade students who attend Wayne Highlands, Wallen Popack, and Western Wayne Middle School. We have three different clubs that meet one to three times a week throughout the whole school year. And so we're getting our team ready. We're ordering glue sticks. We are planning programs. We're making brochures, tallying the glitter and just getting ourselves really psyched up to spend a new school year with all these awesome, 11 to 14-year-olds.
And I got a chance to be involved with one of your pop-up clubs. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But what struck me was that it's so hands-on, project-based, and you have that emphasis on STEAM activities. Talk a little bit more about that and the importance of that for your program.
Yeah, so we really pride ourselves on offering some experiences that the kids might not get otherwise. So This includes, having access to some materials that they might encounter at school, but in a really limited or controlled way. So things like Lego Spike Prime, 3D printers, different building materials, as well as like a huge array of art supplies, which was, when I was in school, that was my fantasy. I wanted the art classes to be like 10 weeks long for every project. So we have all of these cool supplies that the kids can come, and then we have programs that our leaders designed to just as quickly as possible kind of share some principles, but then let the kids kind of take off and have some structure, but a little more freedom than they might have at school to experiment, to build, and the ethos of Pop-Up Club from the very first year that we did this was that we wanted to offer as great a variety of experiences as possible for our local students. So just kind of give them like a taster menu of all of the amazing possibilities that they could encounter, not only in school as they grow up, possibly into, college if they go that way, or into trades if they go that way, but also for hobbies, for their own pleasure, for jobs they might like to get in the summer. So we do a lot of programming in-house, but we also invite many community members, businesses. We take field trips. We try to connect with a lot of the resources that are right here in our area so that these students have their minds open and their possibilities broadened, but also have those personal connections should they choose to continue with something that they get to try at Pop-Up Club. They have an idea of who and where and what they might tap into as they grow to deepen that interest.
Can you mention a few examples of those opportunities?
Sure. So we have, in the last school year, our different students, the three different clubs, had some programming they shared, a lot that was different, kind of tailored to their own little neighborhood. But we had a couple clubs take field trips to veterinarian offices to learn about pet first aid. They got to actually get their hands on some healthy animals. They weren't actually treating anyone's pets. But we have kids interested in health occupations. So they go to the high school and get to try and learn about that program. We've gone to worked with Settlers Hospitality Group to take students to Ledges to learn about hotel management and hospitality or to the bakery at Cocoon and get to actually decorate some baked goods. We've done trips to farms. We've gone to a sugar shack operation. Really, you know, carpentry programs. We've worked with a lot of different artists, including some really generous members of the Wayne County Arts Alliance who have routinely brought our students to the gallery and then kind of shared the current show on display, but then offered them a chance to create some pieces that were, you know, in line or inspired by the piece that's, or by the gallery show on display. And so it's really, it really runs the gamut from like silly minute to win it games to construction projects to some service projects in the community. You know, just part of my excitement to be on your show today is to kind of put out a public call to anyone listening. If you have a cool job, if you have a cool hobby, if you work at an organization in the area, a business or a nonprofit or, you know, whatever it might be, we would love to connect if you want to, you know, come into Pop-Up Club, pop on in and share what you do with our students. We're always kind of on the prowl for new things to bring to our students.
And as I mentioned, I had an opportunity to do something with you guys for Pop-Up Club. I mean, I thought I had a cool job. I'm not sure how the kids felt about it. But we got to do some we had them do commercials. We said, let's figure out how we can incorporate, you know, some radio production and creativity there. And we I think it was a course of like, what, two or three visits? I forgot.
Yeah, you were generous enough to join the Wayne Highlands Pop-Up Club three different times. And originally we thought we might create a podcast. And then we needed to adjust our expectations, which is just a way of programming. So the kids ended up designing in pairs or trios or individually designing a podcast that they would love to host. You helped guide them through the process of sort of honing a little promotional spot for the podcast. And then for the third session, we created little ads for like the sponsors that may have sponsored their podcast. And you actually brought the kids into the WJFF studio, and they absolutely loved getting to come into the studio, put on the headsets, use the microphones. Like, I think that was a top, you know, theme that we did that year.
Well, and we're telling you all this because we have an example of that. This is one of the ads that they created. This is student Chris and you as well, I think, for the automatic,
yes,
the automatic toothbrusher. So we're going to take a break. Not really, but we're going to play that right now. Here's a student Chris and Amanda from the Cooperage's Pop-Up Club and their automatic toothbrusher ad.
It was a dark and stormy night. Danger lurked in every dark corner, and in the deepest, dankest crevice of all, a pair of evil eyes stared forth. But this wasn't some science fiction nightmare. It was your mouth.
Ah, my mouth is so disgusting, but I don't want to brush my teeth.
You need the automatic toothbrusher.
It's one mouthpiece. Two different sides of spinning bristles. Just open, insert the mouthpiece, close mouth, chomp, and let it do its thing.
Ah, the sweet sound of mouth monsters dying.
The automatic toothbrusher.
Amanda, I think you sold me. I want one of those. And Chris,
yeah,
too. That was...
You need to invent that.
Yes, yeah, so that was an example of some of the great creativity that you guys have there for the students at the Pop-Up Club. It's also really great that this is a free program. Talk a little bit more about how that happens.
Yes, this is totally free. And the way that we're able to offer what for the Cooperage Project is our most extensive and resource-heavy and staff-heavy program, we're able to make it free to participating students and families through community partnerships and through grant funding, and public support. So we work closely with the three school districts to get the kids to and from clubs. So the districts generously help arrange and provide busing every single day to take the kids from school to the location of their club. They also have the opportunity to take the late bus home, be picked up at club, and you know, driven with other after-school activity attendees back to their homes. For the Wayne Highlands Club, we host the pop-up club on our own location in the Stoneworks Youth Building right behind the Cooperage. For the Wall and Paw Pack students, we bus them to the Holly Library. And for the Western Maine students, the Hamlin Community Library in their community room is the home base. So we work with the libraries to help, you know, create these friendly spaces. All of our presenters and our field trips, almost all, are offering and sharing their spaces and their time and their talents as volunteers for our students. And then we have a big job. This is one of my jobs, is seeking grants. So we have some really generous private foundations that have funded pop-up club over the years. We have many area businesses, including most of the banks, as well as some other private businesses who participate in something called the EIPC program, where they can elect to donate a portion of their taxes, what would be taxes each year, to qualifying educational programs like pop-up clubs. And then we also beg for business sponsorships and donations all year long to support the Cooperage Project and our programming, because this is exactly the type of program that should be as accessible as possible in terms of finances, in terms of transportation, in terms of timing, all of it. We want as many kids as want to be there to be able to be there with no burden to families. And it's through a pretty concerted, coordinated, and wide-reaching effort that we're able to do that with all of this, these different routes of support.
And before we go, I want to mention the Cooperage's 13th birthday coming up. Tell us how you're celebrating.
Yes. So we, this is very important to us. We spend a lot of time with middle schoolers coming of age, and we ourselves are coming of age, turning 13 this summer. So the Cooperage is hosting a big birthday bash. It's coming up next Friday on August 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Cooperage on Main Street in Honesdale. We're going to have a free event. It's all ages, and we're really pulling out all the stops. So we have Eastern Beast Barbecue food truck coming. They're going to be cooking on site. We have sides and salads coming from Camp Umpies. We have a giant birthday cake and a lot of cupcakes, like four or five different flavors. We also, which I'm really psyched for, it wouldn't be a Cooperage party without some good music. So we have a Scranton band called Lightweight coming in to perform some live music throughout the party. And they are normally a wedding band, so you know they're going to be playing all the songs that you want to sing and dance to. And finally, we are going to cap the night with a homemade piñata. And I'm also, I think, equal to the band, I'm excited for the piñata, because my coworker, Allie, who is our community programs coordinator, her mom found a treasure trove of something, which I won't say exactly what it is, but she found a treasure trove in her basement that she'd been collecting throughout the 1990s. And we are going to stuff all of these objects into our piñata. So if you're intrigued, come on down to the Cooper's 13th birthday party. You can pop in and out as you like, 6 to 9 p.m., on August 29th.
All right. That was Amanda Masters, Director of Programming at the Cooperage Project in Honesdale. To learn more about their after-school programs, upcoming events, or their 13th birthday celebration complete with Mystery Pinata, visit thecooperageproject.org or follow the Cooperage on social media. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. And happy birthday.
Thank you so much, Tim. See you soon.
All right, we're going to take a real break now. When we come back, a century of golf. Hear how the Sullivan County Golf Club is marking its 100th anniversary. That's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill.
On This Old House Radio Hour, we learn what a state-of-the-art home protection system looks like in the age of always-on connectivity.
The DIY alarm systems, anybody can put them in. You need to understand you don't point sensors at heaters, high sunlight.
Plus, how Grammy-winning banjo player Allison Brown became the unlikely steward of Nashville's most notorious address. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This summer marks a major milestone for one of Sullivan County's most beloved landmarks, the Sullivan County Golf Club, celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2025 with 2 days of special events on August 27th and 28th, featuring live music, a long drive competition, art, and special guest appearances. The centennial also comes with a few changes, including course renovations and the opening of a new restaurant, Otto's. Joining us now is Tom Coyne, renowned golf writer and operator of the club, to talk about the history behind the course and what's in store for the celebrations. Good morning, Tom.
Tim, thanks so much for having me. We're big fans of Radio Catskill.
Well, thank you. And, we're neighbors, too. You're just down the road.
Yes, we are neighbors. We bought a house up here in Calicoon, so we always have you guys on in the background. And my wife was very excited that I was getting the chance to come here.
Well, hello. How are you, Mrs. Clark? Congratulations on 100th anniversary of the golf club. What does this milestone mean to you personally, being both an operator of the course and a golf writer?
Yeah, it means a lot because I'm sort of an accidental golf course owner, operator, right? My business is writing about golf and writing golf books. And in 2023, the wonderful superintendent at Sullivan County, Sean Smith, reached out and said, hey, I don't know if we're going to make it to 100 years. It looked like it had been losing money for a number of years and was in a bit of a decline. And at the time I had a book deal and I thought, well, this might be fun. This could be like we bought a zoo. I'll go up and operate it for a year. We'll see what happens. But that first year, we kind of turned things around. So we put together a new ownership partnership and bought the course and invested a lot in bringing it back to life and adding some new amenities, a putting course, a driving range, redoing the clubhouse, getting a new restaurant in. As you mentioned, Otto's has just been wonderful. And really trying to bring something. I mean, 100 years, it was 98 years old at the time. And to not make it to 100, a course that has historical significance, that means a lot to the community. That's one of the oldest golf courses in the Catskills, you know, and there have been so many courses that have closed over the years up here. It was just one of those things like this deserves to keep existing.
Talk a little bit about that history. Since 1925, I think that, you know, people may have driven by it, but not known about its history. Talk about some of the historical things that happened there.
Yeah, well, it starts with our great logo. One of the first things I did, I came in, we didn't have a logo. If you're going to sell merch and make money that way, you need a good logo. So in 1931, one of Liberty's great residents, Otto Hillig, took off in a plane, the Liberty, with his co-pilot, and did the first transatlantic flight to Denmark, leaving from our golf course. So we have a very cool course logo now that is a cross of a golf club, a St. Andrew's cross of a golf club and a propeller. And so that's been really great. So that celebrates our history right off the bat. And so many people, I mean, we have families up here that have played at Sullivan County for four generations. So that kind of stuff you just don't find everywhere in golf. And it wasn't something that I think any of us were ready to let go of. So to get through, to do we did a big remodel on the golf course because it did need upgrading. It needed more love. It needed some changes to sort of keep bringing in the visitor crowd. Which is important up here, obviously. And we've gotten there and we've gotten through the hard work and it's growing in beautifully after a very, very tough spring, with all the rain that we had.
Yeah.
and now to get to 100, when, you know, coming up here in 2023 and I didn't know where Liberty was. I didn't know where Sullivan County was. And now we have a home here. And now we're going to get to celebrate this great event with all our friends and our partners. It's very, very cool.
I'm going to ask you about that event in just a second, but I want to ask you about your golf writing. You've written several acclaimed books about golf, including a course called America. How do you think the Sullivan County Golf Club fits into this larger story of American golf?
Well, it's about to, because the next book, the next book comes out in May. So I did, this, it'll be my sixth book, and there's been this series. I did a course called Ireland, a course called Scotland, a course called America, where I did these sort of crazy golf adventures in the, in through those different countries. I played every all 50 states in the America book. I walked Ireland for 4 months and played the whole country on foot. Scotland, I played 100 rounds in 52 days and tried to qualify for the Open Championship. But this book is a course called Home. And it is, it's different for me because it all happened in one place. Mm-hmm. And Allison, my wife, really liked it because I wasn't disappearing for 4, 5, 8 months at a time. And she knew where I was and got to be, and has really got to be a part of the story as well. So we're really excited for that book to come out in the spring. And hopefully that continues to bring even more people who'd be interested to come see the place where, and meet the people who are in the book and see the place where the story, you know, takes place.
And that big 100th anniversary celebration of the course is the 27th to 28th.
27th and 28th.
And you've got, like I mentioned, a long drive competition, some live music, and some special guests, including someone who has a connection to a very famous golf movie.
Indeed.
Mr. Bill Murray?
Bill Murray.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's been really fun. So when we put to the when we put the new ownership group together, it was great to have Foster Supply Hospitality. You know, everyone knows Sims Foster and how great he and Chris Minnello, all the great things they're doing up here. They've done an incredible job with the clubhouse and the restaurant and made Otto so great. So the partners that I brought to this new partnership so that we could remodel the golf course, build a putting course and driving range and all those things. Bill Murray was one of them. I through golf, it's strange that we've become friends and golf partners, but golf is a funny world that way. And so it was great to get him involved. Mike Madden is a partner as well. He'll be there at the celebration. He's the son of John Madden, the football coach, and lives out in Monterey, but he's very excited to be here next week. And also in our most recent partner was incredibly one of the most famous faces in America right now.
Yeah.
Jason Kelce. So he'll be here on Wednesday and Thursday as well. So a pretty cool opportunity to come hang and play some golf. And we have Jason's Garage beer brand in the pro shop. So have a beer with Jason, meet Bill, all that fun stuff. So we'll have the kickoff party Wednesday evening, grilling stations, oysters. We're going to have a great spread, live music. And then Thursday, we're going to play some golf in the morning, and Bill and I will do a little talk with everybody who's there. So, it's going to be a pretty special way to celebrate 100 years.
And is the public invited?
Absolutely. Everyone listening, you're invited. Please come visit, and support, what we're trying to do at Sullivan County. You know, everything that we make on everything at the club goes back into the club to support local community, rural golf, which I think is really important. So it's just easy. You go to Sullivan County Golf Club, go to our website. You'll see a pop-up right there that says buy your tickets for the event. And you can buy tickets for the party on Wednesday. You can buy tickets for the golf on Thursday. You can buy tickets for both. We would love to see, we'd love to really see the community turn out for it. It would be, it'd be really, really, special to have, to be able to celebrate with the people who it means something to, this place does.
And beyond the centennial, what's next for the Sullivan County Golf Club?
What's next? We still are getting everything cleaned up from all the renovation work we did last year. We'll have, we'll continue to have more events up there. Otto's continues to be open, doing a great, business, and I think is a really, really nice addition to Liberty. And we'll just kind of try to keep improving and bringing people up here on Fridays and weekends and, you know, to enjoy the course. But most importantly, especially during the week, is to create something that's really enjoyable for our local members, who come out and still do enjoy it the way that their parents and grandparents did.
That's Tom Coyne, author and operator of the Sullivan County Golf Club, celebrating its 100th anniversary with special events and some special big guests. Name guests, August 27th and 28th. More information at SullivanCountyGolf.com. And you mentioned earlier Foster Supply. Kirsten Foster, member and co-owner of Foster Supply, and is a former past president of our board of trustees, we should mention. Congratulations again to the Sullivan County Golf Club on that century of golf in the community right here.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Allison. We'll take a break and we'll come back with Alice Howe and Frida, who are playing at the Freebo, who are playing at the Keshecton Pump House this weekend. We'll hear more about their music after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. You may already know that Congress has ended federal funding to public media, but no matter what's happening in Washington now or in the future, this station's best bet is you. Making a donation, that's great. Making a monthly contribution, even better. Knowing we can rely on you helps in uncertain times. Take control of this station's future. Become a sustaining member today. Here's how.
Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, this Saturday night from 6 to 8, the Keshecton Pump House will be filled with music as singer-songwriter Alice Howe and legendary bassist Freebo take the stage. Together, they built a musical partnership that blends Alice's soulful vocals with Freebo's signature fretless bass lines. It's a sound that spans Americana, folk, and blues. Let's listen to a little bit of that. This is a song called She's My Personal GPS.
Let me tell you about my angel, the one you never see. My everyday companion, living deep inside of me. She guides me through the trenches. She gets me out of every mess. She's my Bible, she's my buddy, she's my personal GPS.
Joining us now, Alice Howe and Freebo, to talk about their music, their collaboration, and what to expect at the Pump House this weekend. Hi, guys.
Hey, Tim.
For folks new
good
to
morning.
Your, good morning. For folks new to your music, how do you describe the sound you guys have created together? We heard a little bit of it there.
Yeah, I mean, what you said, it's really a blend of all the styles of music that we both love and are inspired by. It's blues, it's folk, it's Americana, singer-songwriter. I mean, I grew up a little bit later than Freebo, where we come from different generations, but, you know, we both love that real soulful, timeless music. I mean, what would you say, Freebo?
Well, it's roots music, and Americana basically is a combination of blues, country, rock, R&B, folk, and we just write songs that from the heart in many different styles, and the way we present them, when we both write, we write separately and we write together. And when we perform, when Alice plays her songs on guitar, I sing harmonies and play bass. And when I do my songs like that, when you just played Personal GPS, that's me playing guitar and Alice playing bass and singing harmonies. So we go back and forth. We both love harmonies. We both sang in a cappella groups, and we both have very similar tastes in music. So somehow we found each other, and we seem to create this music together that we enjoy, and hopefully other people enjoy it as well.
Your latest album, Alice Howe and Freebo Live, recorded in one take with no overdubs. Why was that important to you, and what does it capture about your music?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Freebo and I have been touring together, playing all over the country and in Europe as well, for the last 7 or 8 years. And we've always wanted to do a very immediate kind of a live record like this, because what we do together in the moment is just very special. It's there's something about, you know, being there with the audience and sharing what we share live that's very different from doing a more produced studio record, which we love doing that as well. And my most recent solo record, which we did at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, and Freebo produced it. We had a great band. That's like a whole different way of capturing music, you know, that, you know, is great, you know, as well. But this is something very, kind of pure and raw and stripped down. And you really get to hear the vocals and really appreciate, you know, the songs for what they are. So,
and if I may add, I think in this world of where you can actually fix a vocal with what we call auto-tune, where AI, and there's so many different ways of creating music that aren't, I might say, that aren't real, that aren't organic. And what we do is we're two people who show up with wooden instruments, guitars, and songs that we wrote, and singing, and it's the real deal. And I think in these days of so much technical stuff, that a lot of people they see that and they go, wow, you two can really do this. So we just happened in a situation where we did a gig, and a friend of ours who has a studio said, hey, well, how'd you like to come in the studio the next day? We'll get a small studio audience, 20 people, and you guys can do a show and we'll record it. We went, okay. And that's what it turned out to be, just Alice and me doing our thing that we've been doing for 7 years and have honed, along with a wonderful guitar player, a guy named Jeff Fielder, who's played on all of Alice's records. We use him all the time. He plays with the Indigo Girls. And what you hear is exactly what we did. And we're very proud of that because it represents all the hard work that we've done our entire lives to learn to do what we do and to work together for those 7 years. And it's just become a very natural kind of a thing. And that's what we hope to present on Saturday night.
And what can listeners expect for Saturday night's show at the Coshecton Pump House? What are they going to experience? And what do you hope they leave with?
Well, really going off what Freebo said, and just the live album. I mean, it's a representation of, of what we'll be bringing on Saturday. If folks want to check out the rest of that record, it's certainly easy to find on all the streaming sites and everything, with the very creative title of Alice Howe and Freebo Live. I mean, you can't mistake what you're going to get there. But we'll be doing a mix of originals and covers. We do some particular covers that we love to interpret of other people's songs, and a lot of our original work. And it's all about just sharing what we do and connecting, and there's really no artifice, no filters. It's just who we are. And I think that if folks are into this style of music, then hopefully they'll come away with something new that that they really hopefully treasure a shared experience. There's nothing like live music.
And I would add to that what we do, and I think ultimately people want to be entertained. So we don't even really try and entertain. We play our music, but we wind up just having a chat with each other and kidding with the audience. And it just winds up being somewhere between entertainment, music, the camaraderie, and we hope that it's just a really good integrative experience.
That's Alice Howe and Freebo performing live Saturday, this Saturday, the 23rd, at the Coshecton Pump House from 6 to 8. For more on their music, visit alicehowe.com or freebomusic.com. And for more about the upcoming performance, you can visit Coshecton Pump House on social media. We'll leave folks with a little bit more of your music. This is Twilight. Thank you both for being here, and have a great show Saturday.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
I know a dirt road in the late afternoon, where the shade and the sunlight gather in pools. There are trees to the right, twisted and wild. To my left is the sea, like a glimmering eye. Well, I'm not the first one, and I won't be the last, who's come to this crossroads and breezed on past.
Alice Howe and Freebo in Twilight. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Open every.
Support comes. For.
Won't stop here. 1 second here. Little technical difficulty in the computer that wants to make sure every click counts.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Eddie Palmieri and Harlem River Drive.
And my problem with Harlem River Drive is that I wanted a crossover, and you know who were my biggest fans? The anti-government movement, the Weathermen.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America. Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. Spotty drizzle today, mostly cloudy later with peaks of sunshine and a high of 70. Sunny pleasant tomorrow, high 77. It's 11 o'clock.